Sherman, February 1st, 1974.
Since 48. Well, I think one major political change, of course, has been the fact that more black people are voting than voted prior to that. Now, everybody who was qualified to vote when I was governor voted, who wanted to vote. But I think the emphasis on voting has helped a great deal. And I think also a great change is the per capita income has been increased greatly. The South has become more industrialized. You're speaking from the South of the whole nation now. The South has become more industrialized. Now, when I was governor from 47 to 51, we brought in more than about a half a billion dollars worth of industry beside the Savannah River plant, which in itself ran probably around $1 billion, maybe more than that now. And Charlie Daniel has made the statement many times that that was the beginning of the Industrial Revolution in South Carolina. We, Mr. Daniel went with me to many places, DuPont, Singer, and a whole lot of companies that we bought down there, and we got those companies to come and locate in South Carolina. And so we have gone from an agricultural economy to now an industrial economy to a large extent, not completely. Agriculture is still important. But industry was emphasized so much from, say, 1947 even up until this day that South Carolina has gotten tremendous industry over this entire period, and it's tended to raise the per capita income of the people. And this, incidentally, has brought about greater employment for all the people. It especially has brought about employment for people who did not have jobs before that paid much, because when the industry came in, there was demand for human resources and manpower, and so they could get jobs in these plants that paid more than and other sources of income. And during the same period, vocational education has been stressed a great deal, and this has been a great change. I recommended to the legislature the first year I was governor the establishment of a system of area trade schools, which envision just about now what they call the tech system. Governor Burns followed me, though, and for some reason didn't seem to favor too much that system of education, and so they cut them back. We had, I believe, about four. Now, as governor, it was growing, but really cut back to two. But later, under Senator Hollins, he recommended a broader system and to call it tech schools. And at any rate, it's all vocational education. And the system was expanded. And today, we have the finest system of vocational education, I think, in the United States. This has trained many people to get better jobs. It's trained many people to become skilled, and has improved the economy, not only helping the families, but the taxes they pay because they make more money, and so forth. During this period, from 1948 up until now, there's the Supreme Court decision of 1954 falls in that period, which provided any child of any race could go to any school. And for the last number of years, the schools in the South have been integrating to a great extent, desegregating, whatever you want to call it. And all the schools that I know of, certainly in my state, are desegregated. And any child of any school could go to any race or any school he wanted to, except the Supreme Court now has reversed this decision and is practically taking the opposite of what it decided in 1954. Now, they don't say any child of any race can go to any school. They take the position that you've got to have a mixture, and if there's no children of a certain race in a certain area, then you've got to haul them in there. And so they're hauling many children up in North Carolina and Charlotte, I understood. They haul one child, I don't know what color he is, but long distance, just to, so they can say they're desegregated. And so the schools have become desegregated. There's a unitary system in South Carolina, and I think, and from what I hear, in most of, if not all, the other southern states. These are some of the big changes, and I'm sure there are many others that have taken place during this period. Tobacco is the number one money crop in South Carolina. The tobacco farmers still have supports, and they have quotas, and acreage is limited. They can only have a certain amount of acres, but it makes those acres very valuable. Acre that has an allotment, land has an allotment on tobacco, it will bring several times what it would without that. And now with the larger demand over the world for tobacco, that's going to make it even more important. Soybeans has come into a very prominent place now. Years ago it was near down, way down on the list of South Carolina crops. Now it's number three in our state in the amount of income. Cotton has dropped from first to second in our state. And in the South, beef cattle has become a very important factor in the economy. Years ago we had dairy cattle and milk and butter production, but practically no beef. Beef was grown out west chiefly. Now the South is growing a tremendous quantity of beef. And egg production, too, has increased in the South. Some people who went into it, though, were disillusioned and have gone out. It hadn't proved as profitable as some of the other agricultural sources of income. As a whole, I think the South has made tremendous advances in every way that I can think of, and it offers unlimited opportunities, in my judgment, not only to people in business, but people in the professions, because when your income increases, when salaries increase, the capita income goes up, that helps the doctor, it helps the lawyer, it helps the preachers, it helps every type of personnel. School teacher salaries have doubled or trebled in this period of time, and school teachers probably receive less now than any other profession for the work they do, any other category, but still it has been greatly increased, which I'm very proud of. Having been a teacher myself, I've always felt that they were underpaid. You may have in mind some other particular question along that you like to ask about.
In 1948, which is the period we're starting out with, is your presidential campaign. Do you consider that a turning point in the South insofar as moving away from the National Democratic Party?
Many people have expressed that opinion to me, and I think it well could have been, Jack. You see, the South had not gone against the Democratic Party up until that time for 100 years. And we did get them to go independent that year. And we carried four states and got the people the feeling that if they didn't vote the National Democratic ticket, the sky wouldn't fall. I remember when I ran on the Senate in 54, which was 6 years later, I wouldn't have dared run on a Republican ticket, though. I don't know. Well, I could have been elected on an independent ticket that time. Although I was on the right end, I guess that is an independent ticket in a way.
Senator, but, you're saying that you would have considered that even though nobody in the history of the United States has ever been elected as a write-in candidate for the United States Senate at that time, that was a, would have been a much better chance than running as a Republican.
To run as a write-in?
Yes.
Might have been. Because to run as a Republican, run as a Republican in 54 would have been very difficult. I doubt if I could have been elected on a Republican ticket. I mean, people just voted Democratic. To be considered the Democratic nominee was to be considered elected, practically. And that's the reason that people felt when Senator Brown was selected as Democratic nominee to succeed Senator Maybank in 1954, that he would be the senator. And but so many people contacted me about running and have 37 or 8 people to select a senator without a vote of the people. That's what it amounted to for 6 years because the general election was considered a mere formality. Was just immoral, they felt. And so I decided to run on the right end. But just to run on a Republican ticket at that time, I don't think anybody could have hardly been elected on a Republican ticket at that time.
I think it has been reported that one of the decisive factors in making the decision to run was Governor Burns' role. He asked you to do it. That was a factor. Was that a
no, factor? Governor Burns didn't ask me to run. Governor Burns asked Don Russell to run, I think.
Well, then after he decided not to run,
well, he didn't decide not to run, I don't think, till after I'd announced. I called Senator Russell and told him that I was going to run. And he said, well, since you're going to run, I won't consider it any further. And I called Brian Dawn and told him that I decided to run. He'd been mentioned. And he said, well, you're going to run, I won't run. I'm not too sure either one of them would have run, though, because they had plenty of time before I announced. I wasn't too anxious to run myself on a write-in basis because when I look back over now, I don't see how in the world we got elected. It's just a long name like mine has a picture of the ballot up yonder that shows the Democratic, shows the name of the officers, starting with the governor known down the list, and the Democratic column in which Senator Brown's name was listed along with the governor and everybody else. Then the Republican is a blank column, no candidates on the Republican column. Then the other is just a blank column. It's not headed right in even. It's just a blank column in case anybody wanted to write in. That's the reason we drew the arrow on our sample ballots to show them where to write it in. So they had to go down that list of offices and find United States Senator, which was on this. And that's what they thought they were doing, because to be the Democratic nominee, as I said, was considered being elected, and it was a hard decision for me to make, but I made up my mind after giving time to Russell and Dawn and the rest of them who had been mentioned, and I made up my mind to run, and I was going to run in regards to who ran once I made the decision. And I called them and told them.
One of the other stories I've heard was Thomas Waring was among those who urged him to run.
He probably did. Tom Waring probably did. after I announced, of course, Governor Burns did announce support for me, and the man, he based it mainly, I think he hinged mainly on the fact that people were denied the right to vote. Although he was a friend of mine, had been, I'd supported him all his life, and he's a friend of my family. But he did then announce his support, and he's about the only office holder in South Carolina, I believe, who did come out open and announce. See, all your state officers were running on the Democratic ticket. Naturally, they had favor putting a cross over the Democratic column. The state newspaper and the Greenwood News, as well as New and Courier, in fact, most of the papers in the state did support me.
Did any of the other editors call you before you announced and offer to support you and urge you to run besides
McQueary? I don't recall that they did. I don't recall that they did. But after I announced, they did support me.
In 64, you then switched to the Republican Party after Senator Goldwater got the nomination.
And what well, now, after I was elected on the write-in ticket, because the people had been denied a right to vote for the senator, they felt, I announced during the race that I would resign and put the office back in the first primary after that election. So that came, that next primary came in June 1956. And so I had to announce in April, so I resigned April the 4th, 1956, and was out of the Senate then until November the 7th, I believe, of that year. Governor George Bell Timmerman Jr. appointed a friend of mine, Thomas A. Walter of Greenville, to be the senator during that period. And then I went back in the office day after the election. I had no opposition in the Democratic primary and had no opposition in the general election. Then I served until 1960. I ran for re-election as a Democrat and was in a primary with Mr. Beverly Hubbard. I won that primary and had no opposition in the general election. Then in 1964, I changed parties, and I had supported President Eisenhower in 1952, and then in 1960 I voted for Mr. Nixon then, although I was a Democrat. In 1964 I supported Senator Goldwater. Then in 1966, I had changed parties. I ran as a Republican, and Bradley Morrow of Greenville ran against me then, and I was elected in that election. And then in 72, of course, I ran again as a Republican, and Mr. Nick Ziegler ran against me then. I was re-elected at that time.
And what happened between 54 and 64? What changes have happened in the state?
Caused me to change parties?
Yes.
Well, I had known the Republican Party was a more conservative party before I came to the Senate. But I didn't realize there was as much difference up here in the parties as I thought. After I got up here, I soon found that the Republican Party was more in line with my thinking and the philosophy of the people of South Carolina than the Democratic Party up here at the national level. And so that's the reason I changed parties. I felt more at home in the Republican Party. I found myself voting with the Republicans, or they with me, or us together, about 70% of the time. And I just felt that, to be honest with myself, I ought to be in the party where most of the people think and feel as I do. And that's the reason I changed parties. I frankly didn't know what effect it would have or whether I could get elected or not. But I was willing to to take the chance because I was confident that the Republicans up here, the great majority of them, felt and voted like the people of South Carolina felt and would vote if they were up here.
You think you'd have made the move if there had been another Republican candidate other than Senator Goldwater?
Depends on who it would have been. I probably would have changed parties, if not that year, probably sometime after that. In other words, if some other conservative man had run, I would have changed. I mean, I was about ready to change parties anyway when 1964 came, because I'd been here long enough to see how it was going. But this just made it easier for me to change at that time, since Senator Goldwater was running. He was well known in the South, and he and I thought very much alike on so many matters. He believed in a strong national defense. He believed the national government was getting too powerful and usurping the rights of the states. And we thought together on a lot of things. So it made it easier to change it at that time and support him. I could have supported him and would have supported him as a Democrat. But if I had then, I would have lost my standing with the Democratic Party here and probably couldn't be as effective through the Democratic machinery as I could be by moving over to the Republican machinery. The only objection to changing the party was whether I could get reelected. And on that, I took the chance.
Excuse me, I have to catch a plane at National. I really wanted to stay for the rest of the interview, but I'm gone, darling.
Well, I'm glad to see you. Fine, it's a pleasure to meet you, too, and good luck to you.
What did you ask, and what sort of, not so much promises in terms of any political commitments, but in terms of commitments on basic issues, did you get at that time, or did he make at that time that impressed you?
Well, he met with the Southern delegates who were in Atlanta at that time. They propounded questions, and I propounded questions, and then he asked me to ride with him to another hotel where he was going, and I agreed to do it, and we talked there too. And at the question, well, let's see now. No, I had talked to him prior to the meeting with Southern delegates too. So we read it three times. Before the Southern delegates met, I talked with him. I talked with him with the Southern delegates, and mostly listened to what they had to say because I'd already talked with him, chiefly. And then I rode with him to this other hotel. During those three times, he made the statement, made statements that appealed to me on a number of very important topics. One was that he believed in a strong national defense. I was a member of the Armed Services Committee up here, and but whether I was a member of the Armed Services Committee or not, I take the same view. And it's my feeling that if we're going to preserve this nation as a free nation, we've got to remain strong militarily. And I told him I favored a military superiority, that we could not afford to be second. And I asked him how he felt about that. Would he stand for a strong national defense, second to none? He said he would. I asked him how he felt about appointing judges to the Supreme Court. Would he appoint judges who believed in the Constitution, would follow the Constitution. In other words, were strict constructors of the Constitution. He said he would. And he went on that point to elaborate that he felt his greatest achievement, if he became president, would be to the appointments he made to the Supreme Court, because his term would only be 8 years if he were reelected, but judges would be on there for 20 or 30 years maybe. And he felt that would be the most important decisions he could make, would be to get the right people on the Supreme Court. Then we discussed about the federal government going into so many fields of activity and dominating the states and too much power going to Washington. And how did he feel about reversing the flow of power? And on that he expressed himself as strongly favoring that. He felt the same as I did about it. And subsequently, as you know, he advocated revenue sharing and money is power, sending money back to the states. And he's taking other positions that would give the states more power. He's tried to decentralize some, not as much as I'd like to see, but he's proceeded along that line considerably. But he expressed himself on that occasion as strongly favoring giving the states more power and reversing that flow of power, so to speak. He also told me, I told him I thought it was foolish not to let children go to the nearest school, the neighborhood schools. And I said, why not let them go to the neighborhood school? If they're not satisfied with that, go to any school they want to, without any discrimination. And he said that he would favor a freedom of choice in schools without discrimination. He said, I do not favor discrimination in any way, shape, or form, but I do favor a freedom of choice. And he advocated that in the campaign. I believe Charlotte, he went on the TV and he so stated, and he so stated here in Washington and some other places during the campaign and after the campaign too. He hadn't been as strong on that, I think, after he got to be president. Maybe he should have been, although he hadn't changed his position so far as I know. But I was hoping he'd come out strongly and advocate that Congress take action to provide a freedom of choice. And that's with no idea in view of discrimination at all. It's with no idea in view that any race is inferior. It's just because the schools are desegregated, and so it wouldn't affect the desegregation. Up until 1954, when I was governor, for instance, our state had laws providing separate schools for different races. As governor, it was my duty to uphold that law until it was changed or stringed down. It was not stringed down while I was governor. Not until 1954. I went out in 1951. And I think other governors in the South had similar laws, and they had responsibility to uphold it too. After the decision was handed down, I never advocated defying the law. I never advocated taking any step that would bring our state in disrepute in any way, shape, or form. At any rate, those were some of the things we discussed. We may have discussed a few more, but the ones I mentioned, I believe, were the chief ones we discussed in Atlanta. And I was satisfied from his answers that he gave me that he was sincere in what he said, and I was satisfied that if he carried out that type of program, which I felt the country needed so badly, that he'd make a great president, and I didn't commit myself to him at that time, though. I came back and gave it some more consideration, and then several weeks later I did endorse him, and I was with him from then on.
And then, in 1970, gubernatorial operates. You actively campaigned for Congressman Watson.
1970, that's right. Well, some people had the idea that I got Watson to run and he was my man and that I was running his race and a whole lot. Now, that is all untrue. I have never advised anybody to run for an office. That's a decision they have to make. I've told them what I would do if I were in their shoes, if they wanted to be governor or wanted to be senator or something else maybe. And I've told them the advantages and I've pointed out disadvantages. I've told them if I felt the state needed them or if they could run their great service. But Watson, that's a decision he made himself, and he had to make it after talking to a lot of people. I know a group of people met with him here in Washington one time, and he met with other people on other occasions and before he decided what to do, because he had a sure seat in Congress, and it was a big decision he had to make. But Watson did announce, and he ran, and I made some speeches for him. He didn't particularly ask me to speak anywhere, but I don't know who arranged these places where I was invited to some places where I just went and spoke, and I spoke in behalf. And then they had some campaign rallies. They had one big one up in Spartanburg. I spoke in Camden once. I don't know whether Watson knew anything about it. I was even going to be there. But I spoke, I rang four or five times, maybe. I doubt if I spoke over half a dozen times for him. But I did speak for him. I felt that he was an able man, and I felt he was a progressive man, and yet he would be sound in his views with regard to industry and sound in his views with regard to schools and sound in his education and progress, and I considered him of a conservative philosophy of the school of thought to which I belonged.
And he lost that campaign, and in that election, John West got almost all of the black vote that didn't go for the black candidate in that race.
I expect he did. I imagine he did.
And subsequently, when you appointed Tom Moss to your staff, which sort of, I think, set a precedent for the South Carolina congressional delegation in so doing. And many observers back in South Carolina were saying that you were recognizing the importance of the black vote and also reading, in fact, reading the returns of the 1970 election and giving greater recognition to increased black vote. With your own reelection campaign coming up. And how do you feel, you know, coming into the 72 campaign insofar as black voters were concerned? And that this is somewhat of a new phenomenon still in South Carolina.
Well, now, my race in 70, when Watson ran, my race was 4 years off at that time. And I didn't give too much thought about my race at that time. It's 2 years off. That's right. Well, I figured the people of South Carolina knew me and what I stood for, and regardless of who I supported in some other race, that they'd make their own judgment on me. And I think that's the way most of them will do in races. I don't think they blame a man. Sometimes I think they admire a man more, probably if he expressed himself, although in a lot of times it's not necessary to do it. And I think it's the fellow candidate has to, and also have to determine himself whether it's wise under the circumstances to do it. The 1954 decision provided any child could go to any school, and that began to open up the schools to all races. That began to acknowledge, you might say, the black race more than it had been before. And one step after another came along and was taken, and the black people were given more responsible positions, which was nothing but right, and I've never objected to a black person having the best opportunity possible or doing everything he can to promote himself, because it's not a man's color that counts, it's what's in his heart that counts. It's not a man's race, it's his manners. And as time went on, I had staff, I had no black people on my staff, I guess, until about 1971. And I think the time had come. Sometimes you can do things too quickly and take a step that will cause a setback, but I felt the time had arrived that it would be proper to appoint black people to the staff, and I appointed Tom Moss as the first black person. And we appointed a number of them since then. We have a black girl back here now from Orangeburg. It's a good, a very competent girl. She's a filing clerk. Just about the best we've had, as good as we've had. There's another black girl at Wake Chair. She's studying law up here now. We have on part-time now. She works on afternoons, weekends, and works in the office part-time. And she worked here full-time until she got married. She married a doctor here, and he's interning. And they need some additional income to make it while he interns and while she studies law. And so we are giving her part-time employment. And we have had black interns here. I've got one coming here, I believe, this summer. One is named for me, by the way. And we'll probably have several. We don't turn any of them down on kind of race. We haven't had too many black ones to apply as interns, but we've taken all who apply. And I've appointed black people to academies. I appointed one from Anderson a year or two ago. He president of class and leader and student body and everything, but he didn't he didn't make the entrance examination, I believe. Anyway, he wasn't admitted, but I felt he was outstanding, and probably if he'd gotten there, he would have made it. But anyway, they didn't admit him, but I appointed him. I wanted him to have that opportunity, and I take pleasure in trying to help people who are needy and worthy. And in the foundation I've established, we have helped any number of black students. At Strom Thurmond High School, I established with my own personal money about $13,000 in scholarships there, and they use the income, and most of those have been black students because the school's about 70% black. And so we have tried to do all we could to help them. I've always helped. I helped educate a black dentist several years ago before 1954 came. I mean, I guess it was before 54 anyhow. It was years ago, and back when I was a state senator, I loaned money and gave money to black students to go to college on, and I've loaned and given money to blacks to help them all my life. I've worked around black people, and I know them, and got along with them. I've defended them in court with no charge when they were not able to pay when I was practicing law, and so my relations with the black people have always been good. But when I ran for president on states' rights ticket, I think a great many of those leaders misled their people and telling them that states' rights was against their best interest, and I didn't get the support I should have gotten from the black people. And it's taken some time to overcome that. I don't know if we've overcome it entirely yet, but we've tried to do what was right by them and to help them every way we could.
Do you have a few more minutes?
Go ahead, Jim. Sorry, go ahead a few minutes. Who is that out there?
Mr. Balzer, they asked you to come at 3.
For what? Would you mind? Let me see him a few minutes and then come back.
Sunday Ed mentioned that there was one thing he thought that you meant to add in that conversation you had that time with Mr. Nixon on textiles, so that was one of the other things you discussed.
Yes, that was another point we discussed, which I overlooked telling you a few moments ago. I told him that textiles was a number one industry in South Carolina and a number of other states such as North Carolina and Georgia, and was the largest industry in the United States employing people, I believe. I think it employs about 2 million people. And it was of great importance to the economy of the whole nation that on account of excessive imports coming into the United States, that large numbers of mills had been closed in many states, quite a number in South Carolina included, and that I want to know how he felt about protecting American industry here, and especially the textiles. And he expressed himself that he felt the steps should be taken to protect the American workers, and that he would take steps to do that. And then after the nomination was over, he sent me a wire between the nomination and the election confirming that statement, and that he would take steps to do that. And the recent agreements that they've got now, signed by, I believe, 50 nations, was it, of the United States, was really a fulfillment of the commitment he made on textiles between his nomination and his election.
When you hired Tom Moss, how did you define the job? What did you want him to do?
Well, he works out of the Columbia office, just the same as other people who work there. He has a desk there, but he travels a great deal among people of his own race. Now, he was instructed to help anybody, white or black, who needed help, and pass on to us information where they needed help, regardless of who they were, but for him to give special emphasis to his own people, because I felt that he would have an entree with his own people. They would confide more in him when they needed help, whether it's Social Security, transferring a soldier, or a passport, or whatever it was, that they'd probably place more confidence in him than they would someone else. And so he has worked chiefly with the black people, but not all together. And in the Columbia office, when he's there, he helps anybody who comes in that wants help. Out in the field, he does the same thing. But he makes special visits to the black people, and he visits those he feels need his services. Occasionally, I think he visits some schools and colleges, and he tries to remain in touch with the leaders of his race to find out what they need and what help he can render. In a matter of employment, we've helped any number of black people get jobs. We've helped some of them get high jobs here in Washington, and we've recommended others for promotion. And he's been in touch with his people as not only as a liaison officer, but as an effective staff member.
And a lot of people in South Carolina were surprised when Victoria DeLee ended up supporting you. Did your support of her daycare center and so forth lead to that? And did that grow out of Tom Moss's work?
No, I don't believe it did. I think she called on us for help. I believe she said she'd been to other people in political office, Washington, and Columbia, maybe other places, and didn't get any help. I think she said I was the last resort. She came to me, and so we helped her. I guess Tom Moss, I'm sure, knows her. Now, whether or not he talked to her and suggested she come to me, I don't know. He's never mentioned that, and she's never mentioned that to me, but I think she came on the call because she had nowhere else to go.
Did she call you or what?
I don't remember the nature of contact now. I think probably I'll ask Mr. Carrison on that. Let me see if he remembers. Would you come in here a minute, please? See if he remembers the first contact she made.
I think the word was getting out that you could get things done, and she thought, well, why not try? I'm pretty sure.
Do you remember whether she called us or wrote us first?
Through your executive assistant, who was John Marion Evans at
John
the time.
Evans.
Yes, sir. And she got in touch with him. They had many a conversation, I think, on this, and I talked to her.
She contacted my office first over telephone.
Yes, sir. Remember the TV show, the dialing from Thurman? Sat down there and called.
I've forgotten the details.
Yes,
sir.
Son, I wanted to ask you a couple of non-political questions. If you have just a few minutes, and that is your degree and level of physical fitness and energy and virility and so forth make you sort of a national hero among a lot of people, I think, who agree and disagree with you politically. And the question is, how do you do it? How do you keep so fit?
Well, I don't know that I'm much more fit than Mr. Carrison now, who plays golf.
I wouldn't race you, son.
Maybe Ed there, you play golf.
Now, what kind of a schedule do you follow? What kind of how do you look at it yourself?
Well, I get up between 6 and 6:30, somewhere in that range, and then I do calisthenics for about 12, 15 minutes. I don't do too many push-ups now, but I do varied exercise. It's better, I think. Well, for instance, I do a few push-ups.
What do you call a few?
Well, anyway, 25, 50. I do several dozen kick-ups with each leg and lie on the floor and raise my feet over my head several dozen times. And then I stretch as far as I can to each side. Stretch till it hurts. In other words, hold my hips straight and go just as far as I can each way. Then I go back as far as I can backwards and stretch that way. And then I do a few dozen deep breaths. If in any event I can't run, I do 6-7 dozen, but probably do just a couple of dozen to just kind of warm up a little before I run. Then I lift weights, several dozen, about 3 dozen, actually 37 times generally, these weights. I guess I weigh about 50 pounds. I lie on the table and lift them up and down just to flex my muscles some. What I try to do is to exercise all the muscles a little bit, I even take some neck exercise. Twist my head, my neck, to remember that up, and then I put my hands over my head and go down and touch the floor several dozen times. I don't think any exercise does you good unless it hurts. I think it's got to, as some actors say, it hurts, it hurts, it hurts. Well, it hurts when you take exercise to do you good. You've got to get the ligaments and muscles really stretched out. And get those joints moving, and I do squatting exercise. I go down and touch the floor and come back up like that. I do that for about 12, 15 minutes. Then I run about 3 miles.
How fast? What time?
Not too fast. I imagine probably nine minutes to the mile. It's on level ground. Now, that's a little hilly. I run down the hill a piece. Generally, I'd run about 20, 22 to 25 minutes, 3 miles, but since it's hilly there, I'll probably run 27 to 30 minutes, so it's not too, about 27.
Fast jog?
I guess you'd call it a fast jog.
How about diet?
I eat anything I want. I try to avoid desserts and sweets, generally. I try not to eat anything with sugar. Occasionally, I eat a piece of pecan pie or something, but not too often. I'm very fond of pecans, because you want to keep those around. They'll put on a little weight, but probably not too much. They have a lot of protein in them, though, too. I try to eat protein food as much as I can. Now, milk agrees with children, but doesn't agree with a lot of adults. And if I take over one glass of milk, it generates a little gas on my stomach. But I drink skim milk for breakfast and buttermilk for lunch. Don't take any milk at night. Frequently drink a glass of bouillon, beef bouillon, which is, I think, helpful.
Do you drink coffee or tea?
Don't drink coffee or tea either. Coffee has caffeine, and then most people use sugar, and they're both bad for you. My father never did drink coffee, and he wouldn't let the children drink coffee. And I don't think it's very good for people. Of course, some people like it to the extent they're willing to do it, just like some people like cigarette smoking. They'll do it, although they know it probably isn't best, but they get enjoyment out of it, and you have to balance one thing against the other.
Have you ever smoked?
No, I never have smoked a cigarette in my life. At all. I have taken a glass of champagne or something like that at some special occasion, but as a policy, I don't drink.
How many times a week do you
run? I run every day in the week. Now, sometimes on prayer meeting days, when they change it back to 8 o'clock, I skip in, but we're going back to 8:30 now. I'd say traveling sometimes don't get to run. I probably average minimum 5 and frequently run 7 days a week.
How much sleep?
Well, I try to get 8 hours. I rarely get it, about 7, I guess.
Time I've been with you didn't get 8 hours. Some of the times I've been with you in a campaign, you didn't get 8 hours. Wasn't
that
much time left?
In fact, really, if I get 6 good hours of sleep, that's about all I need. Some people require more.
How long?
I get undisturbed sleep, but I haven't gotten any undisturbed sleep since my children were born. I get up in the night and check on them, quickly, and our little girl, such an early riser, 6 o'clock, she's up and she's in our room between 6 and 6:15 in the morning. So, of course, we get up and we used to try to go back to bed then. We try to keep her quiet until the baby wakes up, generally about 30, 45 minutes later.
How long have you followed that exercise routine?
Well, I coached athletics when I finished college, and even when I was studying law, I played tennis. I didn't especially run so much back then. I just probably in the last, 64, probably the last 15 years I've been running most of them. Then I played tennis, and I didn't, but I did calisthenics, and I did push-ups. I did as high as 8 and 9 and have gone over 100 push-ups. Push-ups are such pressure. And the doctor advised me now at my age not to do too many push-ups. He said he thinks it's unnecessary and doesn't do that much good. He said it does you more good to try to exercise all your muscles rather than to over-exercise a few. And so that's what I've been trying.
But have you done calisthenics almost daily since you were in
college? I've done calisthenics just about daily almost since I finished college.
Weren't you on a...
I was on track team and cross-country teams. Ran 2 miles, 3 miles, and 5 miles.
So you like
I think that really the secret to health, more or less, is blood circulation. And you get that through exercise and proper diet. So exercise and diet, I think, are really secrets to health. Your blood, your blood cell, I mean your body cells are nothing but what the blood sends there. If it doesn't send blood there, you get flabby, you get soft, and you lose a use, and you have an erosion of any part of the body. Uh-huh. It's got to have blood. The blood feeds it, just like feeds your eyes. It feeds every part of your body. And it's got to have exercise to do that. And the other thing is you're nothing but what you eat. You eat sugar and candy, you have that kind of a body. You eat meats and vegetables and soybeans. You know, we keep soybeans too at home. And see, what are these other bottles of beans we have? They come. Those toasted. Were those soybeans?
Yeah, those were soybeans.
Those soybeans. And then pecans. We eat a lot of pecans. I think they're good for it too.
How about wheat germ?
We take wheat germ. I take a little wheat germ every morning.
How about vitamins?
A couple spoons full. I take vitamins every day. And my wife's not as strong on vitamins as I am, and I was taking about 30 or 40 of them. She didn't like them. I had to bring them to the office to keep them from seeing them. Taking that many. The Navy puts out a vitamin amateur calcium, I guess, familiar with it. One a day, they claim.
Yes,
it gives
that.
You about all you need, but they claim, but I found those other vitamins gave me a little more lift, a little more energy.
You take just a variety.
And you could do it just a little easier. So we take a number of vitamins. We take some gelatin tablets every day too, which is supposed to be good for nails, but I've been reading lately it doesn't do as much for you as they claim it does.
You decided how big a family you want?
Well, we'll let nature take care of that. Then we're on the way.
I understand that.
But people can, I think people, if they just reasonably live right, if they leave off whiskey and cigarette smoking, and take reasonable exercise, they don't have to overdo it. Walking is even good if you can't run. And use reasonable sense and diet. Leave off fats and leave off sugary desserts. And I love apricots. That's a better dessert for me than some kind of pie. I like it better in the first place, and the second place is better for you.
You don't eat bread either, do you, son?
Very little bread. I like good bread, though, especially homemade rolls and occasionally. I'll eat some of this real good bread. The kind of bread we keep at home is sprouted wheat bread. That's the whole sprouted wheat. It's a dark bread, where the grain is sprouted. And that's the kind we use with the children, and I don't eat much of that, but it's what I eat when they do.
How about fruit and fruit juice?
I eat a whole grapefruit every day, or either juice of a whole grapefruit. And a big glass of orange juice. First, I start out with a can of prune juice. Then I drink a glass of hot water. Old Sonny Tillman said if people drank hot water, half the troubles would be gone. At any rate, I'd rather drink.
What does hot water do?
I'd rather drink ice water. I don't like ice water. Ice isn't good for it. Ice congests your system. Heat, and that's the advantage in a hot bath. That'll make your blood circulate. In other words, you can end up with cold water just to close your pores for going out. Otherwise, it's better just to use a hot bath. That makes your blood circulate. Get in the tub or get under a shower and it's hot.
When you say you drink hot water, you mean tap water or warmer than that?
Just tap water. Well, you can get it so hot you can't drink it. I drink it as hot as I can drink it. Hot as I can drink it. Then I don't put in the fruit juice on my stomach because the acid until I eat a little something. So I'll eat some white of eggs. Once a week I eat eggs, a whole egg. But the rest of the time when I eat eggs, I eat white of egg. The yolk is the cholesterol forming the fat part. And put the eggs or a piece of bread or something on your stomach. Grits or meat and that or whatever kind of meat. And then drink your juices from then on along with it. The doctor said never drink a glass of orange juice or that on the empty stomach.
Any kind of meat that you avoid or particularly like meat or fowl or fish?
I like meat, but I cut all the fat off that I can get off. And chicken, of course the skin on chicken is a little fat, but it's not too much. I just eat chicken like it is. Unless there's some special fat somewhere. And
do you have a taste for fish?
Yeah, seafood? I love fish. Yeah, I love seafood. Last night my wife got mad because I didn't come on home. I stopped those dogs, they dug the oysters. Well, matter of fact, they're a little high in cholesterol and I don't eat them often. But they're good. Probably the best seafood with the least fat is crab meat. And we love crab meat. It's hard. We used to get it here every week. Miss Neighbors got it for us from Buford, but it seems to stop sending it up in there. We've had other with crab meat.
Are you strict in any way as far as fried food, like fried chicken or fish?
Yeah, I eat fried chicken. But it's better if you don't eat anything fried. But you can't always get food that way. And then if you can, occasionally you want a little change anyway. Main thing is just try to avoid the fats. That's the main thing. Lean meats is what you ought to eat. Oh, lean meats, fish or fowl. When no fat meats. Bacon is bad. Pork is bad. Now lean ham is all right. You need some ham that has some elements that other beef doesn't have, and it could cut the fat out. Sometimes you get meat, you can't hardly cut the fat. The best thing is don't eat it. The wives will cook it anyway if you don't watch them, because they don't want to waste it. But where fat's mixed in with the lean, it's better not to cook it at all.